It is Friday, December the 7th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, former U.S. President George H.W. Bush honored by friends and family.
My grandfather was thankful for his country. He was grateful to lead a country where people can go as far and as fast as their dreams can take them.
Lots of issues surrounding a Chinese telecom company and its CFO.
Some of our leading telecommunications companies are counting on continuing business with this firm.
Also ahead, a warning from the Red Cross regarding Syria, plus some sounds from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Thousands waved, cheered along the route as a funeral train carrying former U.S. President George H.W. Bush to his final resting place was traveling by. The scenes were reminiscent of a bygone era, following more of a somber tone of a funeral service at a Houston church where Mr. Bush's former Secretary of State and confidant for decades, James Baker, spoke.
After becoming the youngest naval aviator, he served in increasingly responsible positions on behalf of his country. Congressman, ambassador to China and to the United Nations, director of the CIA, and vice president. Then, as history will faithfully record, he became one of our nation's finest presidents, and beyond any doubt, our nation's very best one-term president. For millions and millions across the globe, the world became a better place because George Bush occupied the White House for 4 years. He was not considered a skilled speaker, but his deeds were quite eloquent. And he demonstrated their eloquence by carving them into the hard granite of history. They expressed his moral character, and they reflected his decency, his boundless kindness and consideration of others, his determination always to do the right thing and always to do that to the very best of his ability. They testify to a life nobly lived. He possessed the classic virtues of our civilization and of his faith, the same virtues that express what is really best about this country. These same ideals were known to and they were shared by our founding fathers. George Bush was temperate in thought, in word, and in deed. He considered his choices, and then he chose wisely. The Berlin Wall fell in November 1989, less than 1 year into his presidency. It was a remarkable triumph for American foreign policy. As joyous East and West Germans danced on the remains of that hated wall, George Bush could have joined them, metaphorically, and claimed victory for the West, for America, and frankly, for himself. But he did not. He knew better. He understood that humility toward and not humiliation of a fallen adversary was the very best path to peace and reconciliation.
And President Bush's grandson, George P. Bush, also spoke about the late president.
My grandfather was thankful for his country. He was grateful to lead a country where people can go as far and as fast as their dreams can take them, a place where individuals working alone or in groups can help the condition of their fellow man on a voluntary basis, a bright hope for America he evoked so brilliantly when he spoke of 1,000 points of light. He often spoke about the timeless creed of duty, honor, country, the values that have sustained the Republic for its over 240 years. But this wasn't something he just talked about. This is something he lived.
President Bush was laid to rest at his presidential library at the Texas City of College Station. That's Texas A&M University there, alongside his wife of 73 years, Barbara, who died earlier in the year, and his daughter, Robin, who succumbed to leukemia in childhood.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
China has demanded that Canada free the chief financial officer of the giant Chinese telecom, Huawei, following her arrest as the U.S. seeks to have her extradited for alleged Iran sanctions violations. The arrest of Meng Wanzhou, which happened on December 1st and was only made public this week, occurs just days after the U.S. and China agreed to a truce in their tariff and counter-tariff trade tensions. U.S. officials consider Huawei, with its massive cell phone and networking equipment presence, a potential national security threat. Australia and New Zealand have barred Huawei from providing this next generation of 5G technology. Britain's largest mobile provider, BT, said it was removing the company from providing 5G for its wireless networks over espionage concerns. Meantime, media reports indicate the U.S. investigation was launched earlier this year into possible sanctions violations. News of the arrest upset global markets, and it follows a 7-year ban on the sale of critical U.S. components to Chinese smartphone maker ZTE over sanctions violations linked to Iran and North Korea. An agreement between the United States and China averted the company's collapse. Nelson Wiseman is a political scientist at the University of Toronto. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty he expects Canada to follow its Western counterparts in keeping Huawei at arm's length.
The bigger debate going on in Canada is whether Canada should join three of the so-called Five Eyes, which are Australia, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, Canada, and the United States, in avoiding using the Chinese tech company in terms of building out this new technology. The Americans have been the most suspicious, and in fact, a letter received from two American senators, Marco Rubio and Mark Warner, of the Intelligence Committee in the U.S., has gained a fair bit of traction in Canada. There's been debate in the intelligence community over this. A current leader in the intelligence community, a civil servant, says, no, we've got good blocks, and this isn't a threat. However, recent heads of our security service, known as CSIS, are very much on the side of going along with the Americans, and I think that view is going to prevail, and that seems to be a growing sentiment among the political class. On the other side, some of our leading telecommunications companies are counting on continuing business with this firm, and I should say that this firm has now many contracts and work with Canadian universities. And I think a lot of academics are naive about how invasive this company can be.
China's embassy in Canada said it resolutely opposes the arrest. Is there a concern that this will damage Canadian-Chinese relations?
Canadian-Chinese relations aren't particularly rosy now. About a year ago, there was talk of a free trade agreement between Canada and China, and the Chinese have been pushing very strongly for this. When the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, was over in China, he was prepared to talk about it, but also wanted elements in such an agreement that dealt with environment, labor issues, and gender issues. The Chinese flatly refused and said we shouldn't compromise any trade deals with what they felt were extraneous issues. And that led to a sort of a frosty standoff. The Chinese continue, through op-eds written by their ambassador here and others, to push for a free trade agreement with China. Some elements in Canadian public policy circles suggest rather than moving toward a free trade agreement, maybe some sectoral agreements could be signed. So that's currently being debated in Canada, but I don't see anything happening for quite a while. Even if you enter into free trade negotiations, they can take often years to iron out. And clearly the Americans would be very skeptical.
Meng, apprehended in Vancouver, faces a bail hearing later today. And in a statement, U.S. Senator Ben Sasse welcomed her arrest, saying, and I quote, "Sometimes Chinese aggression is explicitly state-sponsored, and sometimes it's laundered through many of Beijing's so-called private sector entities." This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of scientists say they have detected an abundance of helium surrounding an exoplanet located only 124 light years from Earth. The scientists say the planet resembles an inflated balloon, and the helium they detected in an extended cloud is escaping from its upper atmosphere. The researchers say they were able to make this discovery with the help of a spectrograph that is connected to the 3.5-meter telescope at the Calar Alto Observatory in Spain. The research and findings have been compiled into a study that has been published in the journal Science. Exeter University's Jessica Spake is a member of the research group that made the discovery. Earlier this year, she led a group of scientists who, for the first time, discovered helium in the atmosphere of an exoplanet called WASP-107b. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. The International Committee of the Red Cross warns that it will take Syria and its people, that is, decades to recover from more than 7 years of warfare. We go to Lisa Schlein at ICRC headquarters in Geneva for our report.
A senior Red Cross official who has just returned from Syria describes the level of destruction in the war-torn country as breathtaking. ICRC Regional Director for the Near and Middle East, Fabrizio Carboni, says he was shocked by the extent of the devastation in the ancient, historic city of Aleppo.
In this city of Aleppo, I've never seen so many people crying. They carry such a weight, a pain, and to many, a sense of lack of hope, which is just breathtaking if you consider the size of the city.
Before the war, Aleppo was the major agricultural center of Syria with a population of around 165,000. Carboni says millions of unexploded ordnance and landmines that have contaminated the country are killing or maiming many innocent civilians. He says the ICRC has the expertise and the orthopedic centers to help the wounded. Carboni says another one of his agency's crucial activities will be to trace the whereabouts of hundreds of thousands of missing people.
It's something which poisons a society, because beyond the pain of not knowing, there are also a lot of consequences. Most of the time, breadwinners are the ones who disappear. So families of missing people are often in a very vulnerable situation.
Carboni says the Red Cross has shared the lists of those who have disappeared or been arrested with Syrian authorities, but he tells VOA no names are provided to the authorities without prior consent from the families of the missing. He notes people on the government side also are victims and have missing relatives. He says learning their fate will provide closure to the bereaved and help them retrieve a semblance of normal life and help move toward peace. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Pope Francis has expressed serious concern about homosexual behavior among some members of the Catholic clergy, saying this is happening as homosexuality becomes fashionable in society. He said the church must be demanding in choosing its candidates for the priesthood and stressed that the vow of celibacy must be observed. His comments were made in a long interview with a Spanish missionary priest published this week in a book titled The Strength of Vocation. It was released in several languages. We get more now from Sabina Castelfranco in Rome.
Pope Francis has made his clearest comments on homosexuality in a new interview, saying there is no place for this type of affection in consecrated life or in the priesthood. In the long interview with the Spanish Claretian father, Fernando Prado, conducted last August, the Pope said homosexuality is a very serious matter and must be discerned adequately with candidates from the beginning. The Roman Catholic Church teaches that homosexual tendency in itself is not sinful, but sex acts between people of the same gender are. The Pope added those who engage in homosexual behavior should not join a life in the church that requires a vow of celibacy to be respected. It is not right, the Pope said, for the holy people of God to live a double life. The new book interview published this week is titled The Strength of Vocation, Consecrated Life Today. In it, the Pope also said, in our societies, it even seems that homosexuality is fashionable, and that mentality in some way also influences the life of the church. Shortly after becoming Pope in 2013, Francis made world headlines aboard a flight back from Brazil when he responded to a reporter's question about homosexuals in the Catholic clergy.
Se una persona è gay e cerca il Signore.
Pope Francis said, if someone is gay and is searching for the Lord and has goodwill, then who am I to judge him? More recently, in a meeting at the Vatican with Juan Carlos Cruz, a gay man from Chile who was a victim of clerical sexual abuse, Pope Francis acknowledged that God had made him this way. Pope Francis has also said that gay children should be treated with understanding. Critics, including within the church, accuse the Pope of creating confusion with remarks they see as contradictory. The August interview is being published as the Holy See continues to battle a storm of criticism over sexual abuse. For years, the Catholic Church has been facing accusations that it has failed to properly deal with sexual abuse, often of boys, by clergymen all over the world. That criticism spiked when the Vatican recently told the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops to delay voting on measures to hold bishops accountable for failing to protect the victims. Pope Francis, who has asked forgiveness for the sins committed by members of the Church, has convened an unprecedented summit of the world's bishops and church leaders at the Vatican from February 21st to 24th, to discuss how to move forward on preventing abuse. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
And still ahead on International Edition, the sounds of Christopher Cross. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Next up, an update on the U.S. political landscape. In 2019, Democrats are set to take over the majority in the lower chamber of Congress. How will they yield their newfound authority? What's the latest on the Russia probe and its impact on President Trump and the life and legacy of former President George H.W. Bush? That's Encounter on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Time now for a little something from the world of music. Christopher Cross is an American singer-songwriter. He won 5 Grammy Awards for his debut album released in 1979. Off that album were many hits, including Arthur's theme from the film Arthur.
Best that you can do is fall.
Also off Cross's debut album is Sailing, which peaked at number one on the Billboard Hot 100 chart and earned 3 Grammy Awards. First played with a cover band named Flash before signing a solo contract. He released a self-titled album at one point, and the Billboard Hot 100 Top 20 hits off that album included Ride Like the Wind. After 1984, Christopher Cross's star quickly dimmed. As the music television network MTV grew to dominate the mainstream music scene in the U.S., Cross's style of music proved to be a bad fit for the network. But he didn't let that daunt him, for tons of fans wanted him out on the road performing in small and large venues alike. Always on his playlist is the song Never Be the Same. Army brat, Christopher Cross is the son of a U.S. Army pediatrician. He He was married to Roseanne Harrison from 1973 and the couple divorced in 1982. In 1988, he married Jan Bunch, divorcing in 2007. He has a son named Justin from his first marriage and two children from his second marriage, son Rain and daughter Madison. Music was always a lot of fun, huh, with Chris Cross singing it. Anyway, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you here. Latest world news is coming up next. We hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington, and we hope you have a super Friday. Now a bit more from Christopher Cross.
Breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Earth and Sky.
I'm Joel Block. Our planet may have reached what scientists call a climate tipping point. Here's more with Earth and Sky's Jorge Salazar.
Thank you, Joel. I spoke with James Hansen, director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York. He described what he calls a climate tipping point, when little, if any, additional forcing from the burning of fossil fuels will be needed to cause large, relatively rapid climate change and impacts. I asked him if our planet was there yet.
Well, we're a lot closer than we thought we were. If we don't roll back emissions and eventually actually the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, then we're going to lose all the sea ice in the Arctic, and we're going to have large sea level rise eventually, as well as many regional climate effects.
Hansen said that right now, carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere is about 385 parts per million, more than 100 parts per million higher than before the Industrial Revolution.
We don't understand how fast ice sheets can respond. But what we're learning is they're responding a lot faster than we realized even a few years ago. So I think we're getting close to the point of no return. We have to begin to make changes within the next few years, or we very well may be beyond a point of no return.
Climate scientist James Hansen speaking with Jorge Salazar. We're Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
From the